This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's true. The United States has troops deployed all over the world, and of course we've been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan since just after 9/11/2001. But the U.S. also does something most other nations do not. We deploy volunteer peacemakers to tackle the most pressing needs of people around the world. Those ambassadors of goodwill are members of a unique organization started over 50 years ago by President John F. Kennedy, the Peace Corps. Carrie Hessler-Radelet was one of those volunteers. She worked in Western Samoa teaching secondary school English. Later, she would spend over two decades working in public health, focusing on HIV/AIDS and maternal and child health. But in the end, she returned to the Peace Corps as its deputy director, then acting director, and now director. She's been doing the right thing for most of her adult life and now seems to be doing things right in her job as the head of the Peace Corps, because under her leadership, the organization has dramatically improved the support it provides to volunteers in the field, and applications to become Peace Corps volunteers have surged to a 40-year high. Later in the program, we'll meet some local former Peace Corps volunteers who will share their experiences. But we begin with Carrie Hessler-Radelet, director of the Peace Corps. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you so much, Mike. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. By the way, she's here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council, and she'll be speaking at noon about the Peace Corps in the 21st century at their luncheon at the Hilton Charlotte Center City. You are invited to go to that. There's a cost to it. Information on our website at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. I'll get it out. The Peace Corps came about at a very idealistic time in our country, obviously before the rash of political assassinations. And as I said, President Kennedy embodied that idealism when he took the stage at his inauguration in 1961, the symbolism of the passing of the torch to a new generation of Americans who were shaped by the horrors of World War II and wanted something in the world to change. Is that idealism still at the roots of today's Peace Corps?
Absolutely. In fact, we do a lot of research about our target audience, which is now millennials, and we find that they are, I would say, even more dedicated and idealistic and wanting to make a difference and believing they can make a difference than I have ever seen. They are idealistic, and that is still the foundation of our work.
I was on your website yesterday and went through the timeline of the history of the Peace Corps, on which you have embedded a lot of public service announcements down through the years about the Peace Corps.
Yes.
And there's even a recent public service announcement. You know, so few television stations now air public service. You don't see them. But I remember seeing the older one.
Absolutely.
Including one that is voiced by, oh, darn, I'm going to forget his name now. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. But my point was going to be that some people have forgotten about the Peace Corps. They've even forgotten that it exists today. But it very much does.
Absolutely.
Exist.
More vibrant than ever.
Why don't we hear about it?
Well, you know, now we mostly are on social media, so we're not on television as much. It's expensive. It doesn't reach as many people, and there are too many channels. So we are really making use of social media, which is the medium that most of our volunteers or applicants use. And so we're all over the social media space, I would say.
And what's the message? What are you telling people?
That there are wonderful volunteer opportunities. It's an opportunity to make a difference in other countries, to gain skills that will help them in a globally connected world that where having language and cross-cultural experience is really valued. And but mostly it's an opportunity to make a difference. That is the message that we promote.
I mentioned that applications for volunteers have surged to a 40-year high.
Absolutely, yes.
How do you explain that? What are you doing?
Well, first of all, I think that part of it is our social media presence, but it's also the fact that we have changed our application process. It used to be pretty cumbersome. It used to take about 8 hours to complete an application. We asked everything we would ever need to know right up front. Now we have streamlined it, and I think most importantly, we have added a choice component. It used to be that you applied to the Peace Corps and we would send you wherever we felt you could best be used. But now we allow people to say that they would like to serve in Senegal or Romania or Indonesia, and they get to choose to apply to a public health program or an agriculture program, an environment program. So we give them the choice, and that puts them in the driver's seat.
Does that seem to be helpful in terms of making it more attractive to people? In the old days,
yes.
If you said, great, you're a member of the Peace Corps, we're going to send you to Senegal, would people say, oh, no, you're not?
Sometimes. But, the truth of the matter is when Peace Corps started, there were very few options for international service. I mean, you could be a missionary, you could serve in the military, or you could go into the Peace Corps. Now there are literally thousands and thousands of ways for people to go overseas and work. And so we needed to make it attractive. It's a much more competitive environment out there. And we also want the best and the brightest. And the smartest people have choices.
But if you're giving people choices, does that make it hard for you to fill the needs of certain areas of the world?
You know, we were afraid of that everyone would want to go to Costa Rica or Fiji. But in fact, what we find is there are people out there who want to go to the very farthest corners of the earth. And every single country has more people applying for it than we can reasonably accommodate.
Of course, numbers like these are always in flux, but the last figure I saw was that you had 7,000 volunteers working all over the world in 65 different
62 countries.
62 countries. Mm-hmm. Has that number of volunteers been fairly steady over the years? Has it grown exponentially since you've taken over and eased the process?
We are confined very much by our budget, and our budget has been flatlined for the last 4 years. We are a federal agency. We get our funding from Congress, and our budget has not gone up, so our numbers have remained steady. And in fact, our numbers have remained steady since about the 70s. The highest number of volunteers we had was in 1968 when we had 16,000, but we've been at around 7,000 for most of our history.
I want to talk about your budget for a second. I was going to put this later in the program, but since you brought it up.
Yes.
This year, it is projected that the United States will spend, and this actually sounds low to me, $598.5 billion on the military, 54% of all federal discretionary spending.
Yeah.
What's your budget?
$379.5 million. And with that, we support over 7,000 volunteers.
Now, I know we have a lot more people in the military and a lot more heavy equipment than you probably have to use. But what does the imbalance in the budget say to people in this country and, more importantly, to people around the world? We're putting hundreds of billions of dollars into the military and a couple of million into you.
Peace. Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to our priorities. Many of our policies are based on fear. That's what I see, and I think increasingly since 9/11. But Peace Corps is very different. The truth of the matter is I'm up on the Hill all the time, and every single member of Congress that I've ever met has been incredibly supportive. But we are so tiny that we are barely noticed in the budget process. Mm. And we are, heavily dominated by our, military industrial complex.
I mean, obviously, we need a strong military. The world is not a safe place in many cases, and we have many interests that we have to protect. But would spending more money on peace initiatives like yours be cheaper and more productive, or am I simply being naive?
Well, I believe so. I mean, frankly,
You believe which?
I believe that spending more resources on preventing violence, hopelessness, and a sense of not being able to control your world, which is why people go into nefarious activities. And from the first place, I mean, we really work from the ground up. We are in communities around the world. And we work with young people who are vulnerable. And we help them to believe in themselves, to believe that they have a future, to have confidence in themselves, and to work hard towards achieving goals. And in places where that doesn't exist, there's a great deal of unemployment. There are young people who are disaffected, see no future. And the prospect of engaging in terrorist activity sometimes appeals to them. And so we really believe that the work that we do is so important, incredibly important, especially in those parts of the world where there are large populations of young people who have no prospects.
There are a lot of non-governmental organizations all over the world who are involved in missionary work and peace work and helping people in developing countries get ahead. Would I be right in saying that the Peace Corps is the only governmental organization involved in doing that?
Absolutely.
Would that be right? Anywhere in the world?
No. Actually, the Fulbright program does have English teachers. It's a smaller part of their program, but they do also send English teachers. But we are our U.S. government's volunteer service program. I also just want to be clear, going back to what we were talking about before, we very much value our military, and in fact, we seek the same ends. We're both all about world peace and friendship. Mm-hmm. We have very different tactics. But I really do believe that you know, if people really took a look at the imbalance, most people would want to spend marginally more on peace building.
You're a fourth generation Peace Corps volunteer and now director of the organization. Fourth generation, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
You're not that old.
I'm not that old. I'm not the youngest either. So the first generation was my Aunt Ginny, who was a Peace Corps volunteer in Turkey. She worked in an orphanage, and she was, in fact, the 10,000th volunteer. And we know this because they did a big media thing on her.
Okay.
It was the luck of the draw. My grandparents went to visit her when she was serving, and they were so impressed by what they saw and how she had grown and what she was able to do that when they retired, they went to serve in Malaysia. So by the time I got through college, you know, more or less I had no choice. I knew that I would want to go into the Peace Corps, and I wanted to be a Peace Corps volunteer since I was 7 years old. I met my husband in college and persuaded him that perhaps he would like to do that as well. He had barely been on a plane before I met him, but we went off to Western Samoa, had a wonderful time, and it changed both of our lives.
Why did you want to be a Peace Corps volunteer? Because your aunt was a Peace Corps volunteer, and you saw that as something that, to aspire to, or was something else going on?
Well, I think it was a whole bunch of different things. I mean, I got an opportunity to see my aunt and how she changed up front and personal. She sent me a lot of little dolls and things like that from other countries, so she got me interested in other countries. My family was pretty well traveled. I was an exchange student in Mexico when I was 14, and I took a gap year and traveled around the world when I was 18. So I was exposed to other countries from a very early age.
It's the second time you mentioned your aunt changing. Your grandparents saw your aunt change. You saw your aunt change. How did she change?
Well, she, first of all, had a much broader perspective on the world, especially in the 50s and the early 60s. And I mean, even to this day, you know, just because of our geographic isolation from other parts of the world, you know, we don't know as much about other countries. And it's very easy to be here in the United States and think that the world revolves around us. So I saw her having a much broader worldview. She got very active in political things, which was interesting to me. It was the 60s. There was a lot happening. I actually have been jealous that I actually was a little bit behind the 60s because there are so many fun things that happened and interesting and life-changing things that happened in the 1960s. So I watched that happen through her lens. She went on and lived overseas for many years. She became a country director for Peace Corps in Thailand, and she has always been a mentor to me. So she was giving me a lot of encouragement, and then, of course, my grandparents were also very encouraging.
So you were a volunteer in the 80s, if I'm not
mistaken?
I was
a Peace Corps volunteer in Western Samoa from 81 until 83.
Teaching English. Did you have a voice in where they sent you at that time, or no. They just said you're going to
They said you're going to Samoa, and I had to look on a map, and it took me a half an hour to find it. It is the tiniest little dot in the Pacific. I started off in Africa. And it's a little tiny island in the Pacific, and it was a beautiful place, and I'm so glad they sent me there. I would never have chosen it because I had never heard of it before, except for Margaret Mead.
Right.
And it was a beautiful, beautiful place to be.
How do you select? How does the Peace Corps select the countries in which it works?
We are invited by our host nation. So we receive letters from presidents of countries saying, please come to the Peace Corps. And then based on that, we will go and do an assessment. It needs to be a place where we feel we can do a good job. We are mostly in developing countries. Mm-hmm. And has to be a place where it's safe enough for our volunteers to serve. And there needs to be adequate medical care, even though we have a very extensive network to help people who become sick. But there has to be a basic level of medical care for us to support our volunteers.
Carrie Hessler-Radelet is a Peace Corps volunteer and the director now of the Peace Corps. We're going to talk some more to her about the organization and its move into the 21st century and meet some other Peace Corps volunteers who are local here in Charlotte when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Black Hawk Hardware, located in the Park Road Shopping Center, locally owned and mismanaged since 1977. Black Hawk, where hardware, home, and garden meet. Info at blackhawkhardware.com. And Aldersgate, undergoing a transformative expansion of its 234-acre campus that will include 62 new apartments and villas. Details at aldersgateccrc.com. Tonight at 7 o'clock, we will be at Lenore Ryan University in the P.E. Monroe Auditorium to talk to Chuck Klosterman, best-selling author of 6 nonfiction books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. He's covered sports and pop culture for ESPN and spent time writing the Ethicist column for the New York Times, among other things. We'll talk to him about a lot of different things tonight. You're invited to be there. You can check out our website for details on when it's, where it is and how to get there. But you'll also hear the program here tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the White House asks for a Supreme Court ruling on immigration reform, what's ahead for the president's plan, prospects for reform, and what the 2016 presidential candidates say should be done.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Peace Corps today with Kerry Hessler-Radelet, who is the director of the Peace Corps and a volunteer in Western Samoa from 1981 to 1983. You went to teach English in Western Samoa. Why did they feel a need for somebody to teach them English in 1981?
Well, you know, I have to say that it is the most requested job assignment from anywhere in all parts of the world.
Because it's in the Pacific is, and well, it's an island and it's beautiful.
That's a reason to go there. But teaching English now, especially now in this global economy, is the ticket to getting a job. And in Samoa, because it was so tiny, its university system was run by New Zealand. So primary schools were taught in Samoan, and then all middle school and secondary schools were taught in English. Students had to know English in order to get past sixth grade. So that was, I think, really important. I wasn't sure, to be honest with you. I had all these sort of doubts about, you know, cultural imperialism and what have you. But I have seen from my own experience that having English language capacity makes an entirely huge difference in someone's life.
When you send people out to various nations, I know that education is the primary endeavor that you are involved in. I think I've forgotten.
It's 45%.
But you have them doing all kinds of things like economic development, youth development, agricultural development, and you are expected as a Peace Corps volunteer to develop sustainable solutions to these challenges.
Right.
How do 20-year-olds
great question.
know how to do that? I don't know how to do that.
Right. Well, we train them. We can turn an English major into a community health worker. We have a very extensive 3-month training that is exhausting. But in that 3 months, you learn language, which is most important, so that you can communicate with the local people in their language. Mm-hmm. They learn a lot about the culture, and we give them the basics of technical training. And the technical learning takes place throughout their volunteer life cycle. In fact, now we have invested millions, literally, in working with other partners to make sure that our volunteers are technically trained and programmatically supported so that they can work on those interventions that have proven through evidence to be most effective achieving development impact. So we are very data-driven, and we work very closely with our university and NGO partners to make sure volunteers are doing the right thing. But the important thing about our work is that it is community-led. So even though volunteers go in as teachers or health workers or agricultural specialists or youth development workers, when they get there, they spend a significant portion of time just settling into their community so that they can begin to understand who are the change agents, what are the real issues in the community, what are the opportunities for development, and what are the barriers to development, and how can we catalyze change from within the community to address the problems that are most important to them. So we go in, for example, my own experience, I went in as an English teacher and I taught. That's a relatively structured job. But after school, I had a girls' club, a girls' leadership club. We had a library. I did some work around disaster preparedness with the Red Cross because there were absolutely no plans, guidelines around disasters, natural disasters, and Samoa experiences all of them. They get earthquakes, they get typhoons, they get tsunamis, they get storm surges. So they didn't have any kind of disaster action plan. That was not in my job description, but I spent a lot of time doing that because that was a need that the community felt.
And how did you know how to develop a disaster plan?
I had done some disaster relief work as a volunteer prior to that time. I did several church-related trips, and my background was in communication. So my part of it was the National Public Awareness Campaign part of it. We had experts from the Red Cross that helped with the technical content. But I led a National Public Awareness Campaign, and I think that's one thing about Peace Corps is 20-somethings get experience that they would never get anywhere else. And the reason you do it is because there's no one else to do it. So at age 24, I was running a National Public Awareness Campaign that involved TV and radio, and I would never have had the chance to do that here.
But a lot of the places that you work are places that value, unlike America, elderly people.
Exactly.
They have the wisdom of the area,
yes,
in their collective brains. How do they feel about these 20-year-old whippersnappers from another part of the world coming in and telling them how to make life better?
Well, you know, that's why you have to be really careful. And that's why, first of all, having the language and understanding the culture is so important. And that's why that settling in period of really getting to know your community, you know, having tea with the village elder, understanding what is important to him or her,
mm-hmm,
and working on their priorities is so important. It's also a reason why it's so important for us to recruit older Americans, 50-plusers. And we find that by having a volunteer force of all ages, it just, first of all, sends a message that we value all ages, but second of all, really brings the wisdom of people with more life experience.
Well, you
just
kind of answered a question from one of our listeners on social media. Lauren writes in, does the Peace Corps offer opportunities for older, mid-career, and or married couples? And the answer is obviously
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I was married when I went in, so we have about 10%, somewhere between 7 and 10% are married couples, and then about 7, 8, 9% of our volunteers over the years have been over 50. My own grandparents were in their 70s when they served, and our oldest volunteer ever was 86.
Wow. So you've streamlined the process of application. You've gotten it down from an 8-hour task to an hour task.
Yes.
And the approval process, the vetting process, you've gotten from a year a waiting period to,
right,
about a 6-month waiting,
right,
period. What are you looking for in an applicant? What is your decision-making process? Why do you choose this person over that person?
Great question. You know, the things we're looking for have actually not changed since 1961. We're looking for people who are highly motivated, who have a history of service. So they say they're interested in service, but that is demonstrated by real life experience doing service in their community prior to their application. We want people who can demonstrate that they are resilient and adaptable, that they have a passion for serving humanity, because we are really about service. And if they have technical skills, we like them, but that is not the first thing we look for. We are really looking for personal characteristics that are going to do well and thrive in our communities.
How do you know they'll cut it? I mean, how do you know when they get into a situation that is not cushy, like we live in America, that they're not going to throw up their hands after the first week and go, I can't do this?
Well, that's why we have a pretty intensive interview process, and that's why we like people who have a lot of previous experience. And we really do quiz them on, you know, how did you deal with a difficult situation? Tell us about when you failed. How did you get back on your feet? We really drill down on that aspect, because it isn't easy. It is a tough job, without question.
The current makeup of the volunteer corps, what's it like? How many men versus women, older versus younger, married versus single, et cetera?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say that especially in recent years under our new reform effort, we have tried very hard to represent the diversity of our nation, and we have had a program that has enabled us to increase the percentage of our applications from people who self-report as minority from about 22% when we came in 2010, and in this past year it was 39% of our applications. So we're very proud of that, because we feel strongly that the volunteer force needs to represent the beautiful diversity of our nation. It's one of our most important messages. So that is a huge priority. 50-plussers is about somewhere between 7 to 9 historically. It's been a little bit higher in recent years, but we'd like to see that go up, actually. I'd love to get 10 to 15% of our volunteers over the age of 50. And our male-female gender balance, it used to be in the early days we had more men than women, but nowadays we have more women than men.
Yeah, I read 63% female, 37% male. Is that,
yeah,
because the guys are either not interested or they're going into the military? military, or they're building their careers in America?
Well, it could be the military. It could be that they're under more pressure to build a career here in the United States, but it also reflects the graduation rate of many of our universities. Women are graduating at higher rates than men, and since we reflect the college population in so many ways, that is, I think, actually the biggest reason.
Read that the average age is 28.
Yes.
Which is interesting to me, because if you get out of college at 21 or 22, what are you doing for those 6 years before you decide, I'm going to stop my career move and join the Peace Corps?
Well, I would say the bulk of our volunteers are still probably between 23 and 26. Mm-hmm. We like them to have a couple of years, at least 1 year outside of college, although we do have people coming right in after college. But a little bit of job experience is really good. And then we have people in their 70s and 80s, so that kind of draws the median out. So that's why.
28 is not exactly
28 is not – that's not truly representative.
As I was going through your timeline yesterday, I brought back some things that I knew but I'd forgotten. Lillian Carter, President Carter's mother, was a Peace Corps volunteer before Jimmy Carter was the president. And she was a Peace Corps volunteer in 1966 – at the age of 68. That woman was amazing
entire
life.
Yes.
How many other well-known people have been members of the Peace Corps?
Oh, many. We have an astronaut, Joe Acaba, first Puerto Rican astronaut and an amazing ambassador in outer space for the Peace Corps. Chris Matthews, who you know probably.
Chris Matthews from MSNBC?
Yes.
He was a Peace Corps volunteer?
Yes, he was.
Who knew?
Yeah. Reed Hastings, who is CEO of Netflix. Taylor Hicks, who is a Hollywood producer and husband of Helen Mirren. I mean, I'm giving you a wide diversity of people, a whole lot of university professors.
And Paul Zongas, Christopher Dodd.
Paul Zongas, Christopher Dodd. We have four members of Congress, including Joe Kennedy, was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Dominican Republic.
Wow.
All walks of life.
The goal of the Peace Corps today is to help people of interested countries in meeting their need for trained men and women to help promote better understanding of Americans and to promote a better understanding of other peoples by Americans. That's always been the mission?
Yes. It has not changed.
And when you talk about interested countries, what makes them interested in the Peace Corps? Is it because we have a really stellar reputation for helping countries? What's going on there? Because it seems to me that we probably had to start this organization fairly slowly and cautiously, and now we've been going for, what, 50 years plus?
55 years.
So people know about the
Peace
Corps.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. If you look back at our history, we've been in now 141 different countries. And some of the countries that we were in the early days are countries where we're having significant problems now. Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, Iran. Those are all countries.
Are we in Iran?
No, we used to be. These are countries where we started early on. Now, so the profile, the footprint has changed, obviously. So we are very much dependent on sort of geopolitics. And it has to be, like I said earlier, places where our volunteers are safe. It has to do with countries that are interested in engaging with the United States and feel that they have something to benefit from having Peace Corps volunteers.
Well, the fact that we were in Iran and we no longer are, and we're kind of mortal enemies, and the fact that we were in Afghanistan as the Peace Corps was there, and now the War Corps is there and has been for a long time.
I can tell you a story about that, actually, really quickly.
All right.
I would love to share this story. Now, this is a story that was told to me secondhand, but it's been corroborated, and that is that General Eikenberry, who then became the ambassador to Afghanistan, went out to visit a small town that had been recently retaken from the Taliban by the U.S. Marines. And during the battle for that town, 15 Marines were lost. So it was a big battle. So General Eikenberry went out to visit this village in his armored vehicle. And when he got there, the village chief came running out, and he was so excited. The Americans were here, and he was shouting, "Rick, Rick, is Rick with you?" And General Eikenberry kind of looked around at his troops, and he said, "Is there someone named Rick here?" And they said, "No, sir." And so they asked the interpreter, you know, through the interpreter, they asked the village chief, "Who's Rick?" And he said, "Rick, Rick, Peace Corps volunteer." Rick was a Peace Corps volunteer that had served there 25 years earlier. He said, "Rick built our irrigation system. It is still running today. We love Rick. We've been waiting for Rick to come back. And when we heard the Americans were coming, we thought Rick would be with them." The story goes that General Eikenberry went back and he could not sleep that night because he thought about those 15 Marines who had died for that village. Their names would never be known. But Rick, who lived there 25 years earlier, was known and loved by that community. It just shows the power of Peace Corps. It shows the power of Peace Corps.
Are there people in countries where we are serving, in where the Peace Corps is operating, who are suspicious of the Peace Corps and see it as maybe not completely altruistic, that maybe there are spies embedded there or have alternative agendas? Or is that just simply not the case because the countries have invited the Peace Corps in?
Well, they have invited the Peace Corps in, but there are countries that where there is still a certain amount of suspicion. My assistant, Clarissa, was a volunteer in Ukraine, and she talks about how in Ukraine, and she actually had to be evacuated from Ukraine, so we had to pull our volunteers out when the conflict began, when Russia attacked Ukraine. And the longer she was there and the more things were building up, the tension was building up, she really noticed that people were becoming more and more suspicious of Americans, some people, especially people who were maybe naturally sided with the Russians. But the government of Ukraine loves the Peace Corps and begged us to come back, and we have just recently returned to Ukraine. We're mostly in the western part of Ukraine. So that's just one example. We have historically, although we're very beloved by communities in Central Asia, the governments of places like Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, have, although they've invited us in, they have always been a little standoffish. But the communities love our volunteers. We've actually left most of those countries. The only one we're still in is the Kyrgyz Republic.
Given that, I know you've talked about the impact on individual people like that tribal leader in Afghanistan, but given the fact that we have been in lots of countries that we are no longer in because we've been disinvited or because it's become too dangerous for Americans to be there, are we effective? Is the Peace Corps effective enough? Can it be effective?
Yeah, I believe it is because I really firmly believe, and this is backed up by so many ambassadors, that we really are the best face of our country abroad. Let me tell you another quick story. Donna Shalala, another well-known Peace Corps volunteer, was in Iran One. So she had this transformative experience. It changed her life. She went on to become Secretary of Health and Human Services. It is the custom when the American Secretary of Health and Human Services goes to the World Health Organization for their annual convening that they give a speech. And typically what has always happened during that speech is when the American secretary stands up to speak, member nations who are not friendly with the United States walk out the door. And so Iran would get up and leave. North Korea would get up and leave. Cuba would get up and leave. That was always the way it's been since we've had these bad relations. When Secretary Shalala went and spoke to the World Health Organization, not only did the Iranian contingent stay, but when her name was announced and she took the podium, they stood up and applauded her.
Why?
Because she was a volunteer in Iran. She speaks Farsi. She knew them. They trusted her. She hadn't been in Iran for 40 years. When that happened. But they knew her, and they knew that she loved the people of Iran.
It just goes to show you, like everything else, when you meet individual people, no matter what your impressions of a group may be, those people can make
it. And I don't even know if she knew those individuals, but they knew that she was someone who loved Iran.
We're talking about the Peace Corps today with Carrie Hessler Radelet, who's the director of the Peace Corps, who served in the Peace Corps as a volunteer in the early 1980s. When we come back, we're going to meet two local people who also have served in the Peace Corps and get their experiences and their impressions of that time in their lives. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, celebrating 75 years of providing leadership in the field of neurosurgery on a local and national level. Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates is on the web at cnsa.com. And the 2015 Charlotte Auto Show, featuring hundreds of 2016 models at the Charlotte Convention Center, November 19th through the 22nd. Tickets at charlotteautoshow.com. CNN.com. The White House asks for a Supreme Court ruling on immigration reform. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, they'll be talking about what's ahead for the president's plan and what the prospects are for reform. That's at 10 this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation about the Peace Corps, now's your chance. You can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or simply email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And we are coming right back.
I'm Robert Siegel. During my years in the news business, I've seen a lot of improvement in cars. Better mileage, fewer emissions, enhanced safety. But here's the greatest advance that I've seen yet. Now, your old car can be turned into more of all things considered. Imagine that. Donate your car to this station and turn it into the programs you love.
Donate your car and get a tax deduction. Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Peace Corps in the 21st century. The Peace Corps over 50 years old, around 55 years old, established by President Kennedy, and Sergeant Shriver, there's a name you haven't heard in a while, Carrie Hessler Rattlett, is director of the Peace Corps, and she is with us in our Spirit Square studio. Before we move on to meet our other guests, I mentioned that Lillian Carter, the president's mother, served in the Peace Corps in India in 1966, thereabouts, for a couple of years. You have a story, I'm told, about Lillian Carter's service.
I do. The Carter Center has an award every year for 50-plus volunteers who have done extraordinary service. And so I met Jimmy Carter a couple of years ago, and he told me this story. And that is that when Miss Lillian was a nurse in the Peace Corps, I believe it was in Gujarat, but wherever she was in India, there was a gardener there who tended the grounds of the hospital. And he was interested in English, and she would teach him a few words, and he would give her tomatoes and lettuce and onions and what have you from the garden. He had a 6-year-old daughter who used to tag along with him, and she was very bright. And so pretty soon Miss Lillian started teaching her regularly. Now, they were untouchables, which meant that they, you know, were very, very poor, and no schools wanted to take an untouchable child. So Miss Lillian taught this little girl for 2 years. And then when she was about to leave, she really wanted that girl to go to school. And she had to beg a Catholic school to take this girl. And they did. But she was the first untouchable ever to go to the school. Miss Lillian continued to pay her school fees throughout her school career. And when she graduated from high school, I think that was the end of it. So Jimmy Carter, fast forward to just like maybe 10 years ago, went to India on a state visit and was at a forum that was attended by the governor of the state and the head of the university and various other prominent business leaders. And the president of the university, a very dynamic young woman, stood up and gave a rousing speech. And Jimmy Carter was there, and he was sitting next to the provost of the university. He remembered the name of this young girl that his mother had helped and had paid the school fees for so many years. But they had lost touch. So he said to the provost of the university, "Do you know the name of the, or do you know this girl? My mother supported her, and we just are curious. We've lost touch with her. Do you know any news about her?" And the provost looked at him sort of quizzically, and he said, "Don't you know? She is the president of the university who just spoke." She had grown up to be the first untouchable president of a major university in India, and she had opened the doors of education for so many poor young boys and girls. She had been an incredible force for good in her nation. It was because Miss Lillian took an interest in her and supported her throughout her school career.
If that is the only story you ever tell about the success of the Peace Corps, that would be enough.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Let's meet some other volunteers from the Peace Corps. Deborah Buckley served as a volunteer in Romania from 2009 to 2011 and again in 2013. And today she is a Charlotte-based recruiter for the Peace Corps. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Excuse me. Thank you. Nice to have you here. And I'm all choked up. And Jim Morrill is a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer and frequent guest on this program. I didn't know this about you, Jim, but from 1973 to 1976, you were a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo in West Africa.
That's right. It's a little sliver of a country next to Ghana, near Nigeria. And it was a long time ago, but it was a great time.
So you were in your 20s at that point in time, and you, as the director said, had some work experience before you went, correct?
Very little, actually. an unfortunate experience working at a bank. Uh-huh. But you kind of find yourself there. I mean, for all the reasons that she laid out, it's a real formative experience for all of us.
And you, Deborah, were a 50-plus Peace Corps volunteer. You had a long career doing something completely different. I'm trying to find that in my notes. You've been in the business world for about 30-plus years as a corporate experience, as a retail buyer, a sales manager, an ad manager. What in that line of work prepared you for the Peace Corps?
Well, that's a good question, because actually the truth of the matter is I also have had years of service. I served homeless families while living in Seattle, Washington for 20 years, and I also served in an organic farming, organic gardening nonprofit organization doing composting, of all things. Love my worm bin. And I had, when I applied to the Peace Corps, I had an interest in doing more environmental type of work, mm-hmm. and made that clear in my cover letter and my statements to the Peace Corps. And that is, in fact, what I did in the Peace Corps. I did nothing having to do with business. I did everything having to do with composting.
Well, I knew that about you, but I didn't know you had previous experience in composting.
Correct.
So I was going to ask you, you were helped develop this composting program in Romania.
Correct.
In 2009.
Correct.
The internet existed. You can read all about composting on the internet.
That's right.
So why
That's
did
right.
they need somebody from America to teach them about composting and develop a program for it?
Well, boring anyone listening, at the time, Romania was part of the European Union. Mm-hmm. And that had been about 3 or 4 years at that juncture. There were rules and regulations put upon them environmentally in many ways, including their landfills. And their landfills were not up to code, lined, off-gassing, et cetera. So for this community or county of 250,000 people, they had to close all their landfills. 65% of the waste table was biodegradable. So how do we get our citizens to stop throwing all their food waste into the landfill that we now have to reserve for basic garbage? Mm-hmm. So I was actually sited in a town called Botoşan, which is in the northeast corner, very close to Moldova and Ukraine. And I worked for the Environmental Protection Agency, a local branch. And I worked with the garbage department, basically. And I had no one was trained in how to compost food and yard lawn waste, if you will. So I was, because I had done that in Seattle, I basically took the course that I had taken in Seattle and brought it to Romania and reproduced it there. And in combination with something they had written to and gotten a program for children out of Brussels. So we kind of took this program and merged the two of them and trained the Parks Department. We started environmental clubs. We trained the people with whom I worked at the Environmental Protection Agency, et cetera.
And what kind of a difference did that make?
Well, first of all, I think it just brought to mind that you could take food waste and instead of throwing it in the landfill,
yeah.
put it in a pile together with brown carbon materials and create this amazing dirt to put back in the ground. And they were already composting, you could argue, out in the villages where they were either feeding their food waste to the chickens or the pigs or putting it in a waste pile. So it wasn't a big leap because so many of these people spend a lot of time in the villages with their grandparents.
Now, Jim, you volunteered in Togo in West Africa in the mid-70s at a younger age. What was your job there?
Well, I was in a school construction program. I mean, what we did was replace schools that were made out of thatched roofs, and these kids had benches they sat in, and the schools fell apart pretty easily. And so what we did was we built schools out of bricks and tin roofs, with local help. We got the money, a lot of it came from the American Embassy. A couple thousand dollars could buy a lot of materials, and then we did self-help projects, which means that we got the local people kind of organized everything, but they did the work themselves.
Kind of like a habitat project.
It's exactly
they
like
put their
a
own
habitat
sweat
project,
equity,
yeah.
Into it. And one of those people that helped you, I understand, was the village chief. How was he and why was the village chief involved in these projects?
Well, I think the chiefs got involved in all the projects like that. Okay. I mean, they were, was good for their village if you could build a school there, if they had a new school, and so they were happy to do it.
And you evidently had made an impression on people because you have a story not unlike the story that the director told a minute ago, this time about the chief.
I think you're talking about the chief in the first village where I worked.
Yeah.
And, you know, we became friends, and I would go out there, and, you know, when he had a kid – when I was there, I stayed for 3 years, and I think it was in my last year he had a kid, and he named him after me. And they pronounced it in the French way, which was Jameis. Mm-hmm. It's French way that pronounced it. So, and then my wife and I went back. She was my fiance at the time. We went back a few years later, and the chief brought everybody in from the fields when we came. We just came to say hello, and he brought everybody in for like a group picture, and he made Jameis wear a shirt. Everybody else did. Nobody else had a shirt on, but Jameis did.
You say that the people of Togo are warm and resilient and have a really hard life with very few natural resources, and they also have to deal with an autocratic government. When people from the Peace Corps come into these situations, we come in with this privileged background of having been in America and in the United States with a democratic form of government and also a lot of wealth. Does any of that rub off? Do the democratic ideals, do the ideas of freedom and freedom of speech rub off on the people that you work with?
I think I have a good example of that in that for anyone who's traveled to developing countries, we know there's oftentimes a dog and cat, stray dog and cat problem. And very true in my town in Romania. And several dogs followed me home. In my purchasing of food, I met a young woman with whom we started an SPCA, basically. And to this date, to back up to your question, they didn't know they could do that sort of thing, that they could raise money, that they could build a website, that they could do public events to raise awareness for animal welfare, that they could interact with the city hall. And today they manage the public shelter for the city of Botoşan, and they have adopted and spayed and neutered and adopted out over 600 dogs.
How much of that fact that they didn't know they could do those things has to do with the fact that they came from living under a communist regime for a long period of time?
Absolutely. In terms of percentage, I don't know, but that's part of it. The other part of it is Romanians are very smart, clever, committed individuals, and their education process is very it's more about not a lot of application. So a woman who goes to veterinarian school could tell you how to spay a dog. She couldn't actually physically do spaying of a dog. So it's a lot of theory and not a lot of practice. So that's part of it as well.
I'm sure that we don't go in, our Peace Corps volunteers don't go into countries trying to reshape them and make them into America light. But surely through conversation, things rub off.
Absolutely.
And people's eyes are opened about the real America, not what they see in movies or read about. Is that the intent? Is that the hope?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our second and third goal are to build relationships between our country and important partner countries and to make sure that they become good global citizens. I would say yes, that's explicit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, one thing that really illustrates this is after the Berlin Wall fell, we immediately went into most of Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
Almost all of those countries. And in fact, in terms of mm-hmm. sort of civic process, it was before my time for sure, but in Slovakia, there was a volunteer, Peace Corps volunteer, who was really behind the whole, you know, enrolling in voting, you know, voter registration and getting out the vote when they were in the very early stages of that process that spread to other countries in Eastern Europe. I wish I could remember the name of the program, but it was really crafted by Peace Corps volunteers.
Some of the places that you send volunteers are not the safest places in the world, and these people are not sitting in heavily guarded embassies. They are boots on the ground,
exactly.
So to speak, in amongst the people. That's the whole idea of it. So how safe are these Peace Corps volunteers when they are in country, and what does the Peace Corps do to keep them safe?
Yeah, I mean, safety and security is the most important thing to us. I spend more time on that than any other single activity. We have a very robust team of local staff, host country nationals, that are very careful about analyzing security data and making sure that our volunteers are in places where they can both serve safely and also have an impact. So we, you know, basically our model of safety and security is integration with the community. We depend on the community to protect our volunteer. And it turns out that, in fact, that's a very effective way. Our communities love our volunteers and they keep them very safe.
Nikki on Facebook writes, I'm wondering whether there have been volunteers who have brought their young children along. I was accepted into the Peace Corps after college but decided not to go for family reasons. I've always wondered, what if? Well, now I'm 30-something, a lawyer, turned stay-at-home mom of two, but I still think about whether I will have another chance at the Peace Corps.
The answer is absolutely yes, you'll have another chance.
Can you bring the kids?
Can I bring the kids now? We did in the early days, actually for a couple of years in the beginning, there were families serving in the Peace Corps, but it's hard for us to really medically support volunteers and make sure that and their children and make sure the kids get education.
I'm sure that Romanian conditions were very different from conditions in Togo. What was life for you in Togo like at first?
Well, it was rough. I mean, it was different than here, and you didn't have a lot of amenities, but you know, you got used to things. You know, you got used to living the way the people lived over there. We had motorcycles in those days, so we could get around a little bit easier. But it was not your basic American life.
In 30 seconds or less, what stays with you from that experience?
I think just the connections with the people, and you know, understanding how they live and why they live that way.
Same question to you, Deborah.
I would agree with Jim, and also I would add back to what Carrie was saying about our aunt, the change. I mean, I went from this corporate life of control and the boss of everyone to let it go, just let it be, choosing happiness.
And clearly you couldn't let it go because you were a volunteer, went off and did other things, and now you're the director of the Peace Corps. That's obviously something that stayed with you for
a
very long time.
Yeah, it's a transformative experience, but the foundation is relationships, I would say. That.
Sergeant Triber, who was the driving force behind the formation of the Peace Corps, said the Peace Corps represents some, if not all, of the best virtues of this society. It stands for everything that America has ever stood for. It stands for everything we believe in and hope to achieve in the world. Carrie Hessler-Radelet is the director of the Peace Corps. Deborah Buckley and Jim Morrill from Charlotte were volunteers in their other parts of their lives. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte